the father of the other piece of advice I was given. First, there is a seminar any educated person should be able to understand. Secondly, on the accident of abuse, understand. And the last thing, you can speak, it should not understand. But we'll have to see how that goes. Well, first of all, the invocation of our patron saint. Then this is the title we're going to tell. So the basic idea of my talk is that dithymorphism in general relativity, that's highfalutin versions of automorphisms or permutations. Some people use the word permutations to apply only to finite sets, other people to allow it to give a broader sense of automorphism. So I just want to indicate the basic concept of what I'm talking about is automorphisms or permutations of a set of homogeneous elements, which in our case would be the points of space-time. And, well, simply, of course, I'll be done with a few of the homogeneous, and we'll see that leads us to the question of is space-time an algebra or a geometry? And the answer will be yes, the whole argument shows that points really are. It must be taken as homogeneous if one has general covariant theory. Then why fibered manifolds, which is a slightly more general thing than fibered bundles. And I'll show the three things that can do. First of all, Einstein's vision, no metric, no nothing. Second, that in general relativity, we shouldn't assume the global power, to go from the local to the global, build up in a way that resembles analytic continuation in the complex real theory. And how you can use the fibered manifolds to avoid the whole argument, moving from fibered manifolds to spaces fibered by an equivalence relation. And then I'll indicate some ways you can generalize, and I use the word generalization here in the technical sense of the word. It's defined by Saunders and Flanders' picture I'll show you in a moment. He's one of my patron saints in mathematics. When I was a student, I studied the Birkhoff and Maclane Survey of Modern Algebra. More recently, I had to read a new book, which was called Postmodern Algebra. So I can say my life has been 50 years between modern algebra and postmodern algebra. In some ways, my whole life in mathematics.
Second one, Flanders and Flanders as well?
No, but there is a McLean Saunders book which does include the category of theory of time things I have studied. The title is not quite as challenging or intriguing. And I'll indicate how geometric objects and natural bundles are the relevant, but as much as you can do to generalize the concept of attention. So this is really generalization in McLean's sense, and here he is. I had the pleasure of meeting him about 50 years after I studied his book, first book. And the other process is abstraction. Again, as defined by McLane, you omit parts of the data describing concept to obtain a more abstract concept. And this way you can move from differential manifolds to topological manifolds by dropping differentiability, and from topological manifolds to sets by dropping continuity. And it's very useful here to use category theory, in particular forgetful functions, to forget about the differentiability or the continuity expression. Okay, now we get to the point I was making about geometry versus algebra. I'm here following, as you'll see, the ideas of Weyl and Shaharevich. So a geometry will be a set of elements together with some relation between them. All the elements are homogeneous, so that the only distinctions they have among themselves are those that result from the relations that are imposed on the set. And they're homogeneous under some group of automorphisms or permutations that preserves all of these relations. This is essentially Klein's definition of a geometry from back in the 19th century. And elsewhere, I sort of played around with the cubic verse of one of our usual books about the relation between things. We have things and relationships we impose on them. So we speak here about the things between the relations, where things are, insofar as they are individualized, are individualized by the relations. And algebra, on the other hand, is a set of elements together with some relation between them, but all the elements are individuated in some way that is independent of the relations. So this is the more standard case of the relation between things. Think of the straight line versus the real number system. The straight line is homogeneous. Points of the line are not individuated in any way. And therefore, the automorphism group would be the one dimension of the homomorphism group in that case. Whereas the numbers, of course, each real number is individuated by its arithmetical properties. So that that the real numbers are not the homomorphism invariants. So an algebraic representation of a space, then, of an abstract space, a geometry, is called an representation of algebraic that's characterized by some coordination of forces. Coordination is a one-one correspondence between the elements of an algebra and a geometry. And of course, what you essentially do when you... Yes.
I think you're using the word algebra in a slightly more restrictive sense that some people use it.
I'm using Chakravarti's definition.
Okay, so that's like a Lie algebra.
Yes, I'm using that distinction in the sense of Weyl and Chakravarti, as I will indicate in a moment. But when we do set up one correspondence with elements of algebra and a geometry, well, then we have to really say, well, we didn't really mean it. So we have to say that any coordinate system is good as any other, in order to get the demand invariance under its arbitrary transformation of coordinate systems. So we make what I call a dialectical detour. We pretend that we have individuated the elements by coordinating them, but then say, well, we didn't really mean it, but any coordinate system is good as any other. And as I indicate, this concept of geometry and coordination go back to Hermann Weyl. Actually, Simon Saunders pointed out to me that Weyl made this point as early as 1929, which I wasn't aware of, but you will find it at least in the classic book. And Chaparevich, in this very nice book on the basic modes of algebra, uses the term algebra in the sense that I use, which, as you point out, is not the only possibility. Well, here is Weyl. Somehow the same guy cut off. But not a good word. It's a young Weyl, most of you have seen the older Weyl. And here's Chaparevich. So representation of an abstract space is geometric then if it characterizes space independently of any coordination. And it's algebraic if the characterization depends on the coordination. And just to give you some idea what I mean by that, I'll give you the example. If you look at Minkowski's papers, he gave it, by the way, algebraic doesn't necessarily apply to real numbers. It could be matrices, any set of elements which individuates, which in algebra is algebraic in this sense. In the sense I'm using it. Rahl, on the other hand, gave an axiomatic characterization of the Minkowski space, along without any reference to coordinate systems, a la Euclid, if you like. And indeed, it's possible in group theoretical characterizations of Minkowski space time. For example, using Poincaré's fourth geometry. If I have more time, I'll show you that, but I'll just do no more than allude to that possibility. And this is actually, I have one powerful talk on developing these ideas. I just mentioned this. One of those leads you into history of science. But maybe I will make a point here that my approach to these things is the important unit of research is a problem, not a discipline. So a problem requires all sorts of tools. When somebody says, when you ask somebody, what do you do? He doesn't say, I use hammers. He says, I build houses. In the course of building houses, I use hammers, I use saws, I use planes, I use whatever needed to do the job. That's why I think we should approach problems in science. We have problems to deal with, and we use history of science, philosophy of science, mathematics, technical physics as tools to solve the problem. We should go where the problem leads. Now, of course, all of us are human and finite, and there might be many directions that we'd like to go in, but we just can't do it. But we should realize that we're just using tools, the best tools that we have available, and not be hung up on boundaries, the disciplinary boundaries. So a few crucial steps that have led to the concept of space-time would be, first of all, the things that Jung even wouldn't know to think of as problematic, but how did we come to represent time intervals by length? Well, as I say, in his article, I'll explain how that came about. Once you do that, how do you combine a length and a time interval into a single two-dimensional diagram? Well, the time interval between the time with length is first, the time interval first represented by length, which is time to Aristotle. The time when they combined a two-dimensional diagram by Varignon is over 2,000 years, so it's not a trivial point. And then, of course, the idea of representing three-dimensional Euclidean space by rotation invariant three-dimensional mutually perpendicular axis goes back no further than Euler, as well. Then, of course, generalization concept of space beyond its use to describe three-dimensional physical spaces took place in the 19th century. Formulation of the concept of acting spaces took place at Grassmann, in the sense of the homogeneous acting spaces. And to go from special to general relativity, you need additional things. To go from special relativity to space, you need additional things. This fourth Euclidean geometry, which I mentioned, that Poincaré did, but didn't realize what he had done himself. Only much later to realize. And for general relativity, you need Riemann space, the variable curvature in two senses of the word. The metric sense, which senses Gaussian curvature in two dimensional subsections of the space time, and the acting sense, the sense of parallel transport, which was not developed until after the development of general relativity. And if I reply to a word with somebody else who's post mature discoveries, I'd pull the development of the concept of parallel transport, a post mature concept. And essentially, if you read Larry Kibbitt's first paper, he says, Riemann should have done this. So he was well aware that it was post-mature, even though he didn't have a word. And then, of course, the generalization is that dropping out of the metric parts, I find the next space to run very quickly as well. But I'll move to that. Now, should I not get the 4-minute discussion about the buses? Yes. At least one person wants it. Okay. So I turn this.
No, no, you don't touch that.
Oh, okay.
I will perform the magic.
Well, so we all do a nice meeting by day. Okay.
Here we are, and we should adjust the lighting appropriately.
Yeah. Why are they giving me that box in the middle? Oh, the light is on. Okay. Let's turn that away. No, it's not this. Okay, no.
Is that good?
If I move that, now it's on. Yeah. But I want to show that it's like Monsieur Jourdain and Molière, you're using prose or you like even though you don't know it. So I want to show you really know about how to even think you don't. Is there anyone here who thinks he doesn't understand the graphing of a function? If so, you have to go back another 10 steps, but I think nobody feels that far left behind if you start with a function, right? So the function we have, we'll now consider a base space, x, the x-axis, and then we have this total space E, which is the three-dimensional space over the base space, but it's not arbitrary three-dimensional base space. So every x that corresponds four possible values of y, so that's a fiber over x in the total space. So there's a vibration of the total space, which is established by the fact that all the y's are by only given x. So the fiber manifold then consists of the total space, base space and a projection, pi, which projects you from the total space into the base space. And the inverse of that projection gives you the fiber x. Nothing that I've said so far requires that, well, in this example, it's the case that, well, if it's really the two-dimensional Euclidean space I start from, then all the fibers would be the same. Will be isomorphic to each other, but nothing requires that to be the case. That's why fiber manifold is slightly more general than the fiber bundle. But if there is an isomorphism between all the fibers, then you usually speak of a typical fiber F, and then you speak of a fiber bundle. Any questions on these ideas so far? So it's just a question of learning a language that you didn't know, perhaps, to describe things that you do know. And now I want to show you that there's a little, even in this simple case, I want to show the interesting topological complications that could come up. If you have the base space as a line, there's only two possibilities topologically, right? It's either an infinite line or it's a closed line, which means topologically it's a circle. So there's only two possibilities of topology. So what does that mean about the bundle? Well, if we draw that total space and label the ends A, B, and A prime, B prime, in the closed case, at least you see two possibilities immediately. You can identify A with A prime and B with B prime, in which case you have a trivial bundle. It's just simply the product of two lines, typical product with the x-axis. On the other hand, you could twist it. I think everybody knows about Möbius strips. You take a piece of paper, there's a Möbius strip here producing, so it's a topologically non-trivial. That's not even an orientable surface. You haven't played with this as a child, or maybe take a piece of paper to do this. Fold it once, cut it down the middle, so you get fold it twice, cut it down the middle, so you get fold it three times, and you can see what you get. As embedded in three spaces, you've got many new interesting properties embedded. But as inherent in the two space, there's only two possibilities, one twist and no twist, is essentially exhausts the topological possibility, inherent topological possibilities of size of the embedded. A little about that erasure of the central law I said there. So you can have twisted bundles, you have trivial bundles, which really are just the products of the typical fiber times the base space, and you get that twisted bundle, which is the example of a topologically complicated one, which is only true locally, that little piece of it is the product of a typical fiber times a bit of a typical base space. Well, the automorphism, just to take a look at that point, something some blind spot up here. The automorphism group in the base space then means the continuous transformations. If you consider it as a topological manifold, then if you add some differential structure, you have to take differential transformations, you get a differential manifold. And if you look at the automorphism group of the base space, well, you see, although you could think of all possible automorphisms, you wouldn't want to preserve the fiber ring. If you're going to talk about a fiber manifold or a fiber bundle, you have an initial condition that demands the fiber going to fibers. So we talk then about fire preserving automorphisms or dithymorphisms, if we talk about French structures. Now, the important concept of a natural bundle, this is the idea which generalizes the concept of tensor about as far as you can take it. What is it that makes a tensor important to us? Well, if you carry out, well, it's usually done in the coordinate language, so in the first statement of the coordinate language, if you carry out a coordinate transformation, the tensor transforms in a definite way onto that. There's no doubt about what happens, right? But it turns out the coordinate language is just a crutch. The model should be anything that you can say about a geometry, you can be able to say geometrically. So you can reformulate all into the language of dithymorphisms, in other words, point transformations on the space, not in the language of coordinate transformations on the RN that you're corresponding to. These ones, at least, to the geometric space. So what defines a natural bundle is that every dithymorphism corresponds to a unique fiber-preserving dithymorphism, and every cross-section, well, I guess, picture I drew a cross-section, and so this is a function of the cross-section of y to x. So the cross-section sigma of a fiber bond is a typical cross-section, one where you take a point on the inverse fiber, 1 point for each fiber, because you demand continuity and differentiability of one. So that's what I mean by a cross-section. So every dithymorphism corresponds to unique fiber preserving dithymorphism. Every cross-section therefore corresponds to unique cross-section under the dithymorphism of the base space. This defines a natural or geometric object. Those are used more or less synonymously. You see there's a very nice book on natural differential operators. That's the sense of what you mean natural. It preserves all these nice properties. And this is about the most general thing you can make that is like a tensor, but more general. And for example, a connection is not a tensor, but it is a geometric object. So that gives you some. And since we know the importance of connections in both general relativity and Lord Yang Mill, Wolf Gay, during a few, it's very important to have a general connection.
Yes. Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
So, I mean, should it be possible? I'm not sure I quite follow what you said. Is it something about it should be possible to describe the geometry just, in principle, just using geometrical objects?
Well, just using geometric language, you should never have to refer to coordinate system if you describe an idea of the geometric concept.
Right.
And for many, many years, people thought you needed coordinate system to describe geometric objects, but you don't.
Right. So would you also agree that in principle you should be able to describe the geometry without having to refer to a manifold and the diffeomorphism? That a geometry is really an equivalence class of manifold and the. And that when you use a manifold to describe a geometry, in a sense, you're committing the same sort of thing that people used to do when they set up a coordinate system.
There is, that's an interesting question, because there is somebody in Malthus who claimed you can do differential geometry without, without different types of differentiation. But I'm not familiar enough to know whether it can be done. Intuitively, one thinks of the fact that one wants to do derivatives, right? If you want to write field equations, you want to do derivatives. And that's the reason why we switch over to differential manifolds.
But
it's a valid question. I don't know how far you can get. As I say, I'm aware of a claim that you really don't need to do the coordinates, but I'm not sufficiently advanced to say good way, let's say. But it's a good point. That's as far as I can go. Do you have much of something?
Well, I was just wondering, do you think that it's that we've really, in a sense, we really made progress with geometrization? If we need to describe things by picking a manifold, is that really much better than describing?
I mean, the question is global manifold?
Sorry?
The globality of the geometry, because I'm going to come to that.
Maybe we'll talk about
that. Can I make a suggestion? Let's bring this back up again.
We'll talk about
it. Great. Sure. Okay.
Can I just make, so your point is that manifold carries all natural labels, just to have coordinates. Each point on the manifold is the.
Well, that's the point that they don't. They're homogeneous. That's what makes it a geometry. If they don't carry natural labels.
So
that would be an algorithm in my sense following the final separation. Interesting for now.
So the manifold is a collection. It's a set of elements.
It's a set of homogeneous, entirely homogeneous elements, insofar as it's a geometry. I can give you an example. Riemann gives two examples, the space, by which you make three spaces, of course, and the color manifold, the manifold of color. And the perceptual colors are defined also by three quantities, say brightness, hue, and saturation, for example. But there is a case in which each element of the color manifold is uniquely distinguished by its qualitative properties, right? One color is not the same. So if you put a metric on the color manifold, for example, then drag the metric across the color manifold, you really do produce a new situation. So just say, I'm going to say, the whole argument would apply in that case. So in that case, the color manifold has an adherent structure on it independent of any metric. This is Bill. At this point, then in general, different determinants of N at 5 to observe determinants of E are independent. You can carry that independently, and that will be important when you discuss the whole argument in a moment or two. And then I'll point out if additional structures live on M, the base manifold, for example, space time structures, automorphisms of M will be restricted to those that leave these structures invariant. For example, there could be a geometry on M. The case that we have physical importance to us in the one-dimensional case where M is the space-time would be, for example, inhomogeneous Galilei or inhomogeneous Lorentz or Poincaré group, which are additional structures both on the base manifold. And in that case, then you have to restrict the group of automorphisms to those that preserve this group. You get a much smaller group, of course, than in fact you get a finite parameter Lie group rather than a four-function group that you do in the case that we have. Okay, so much for the I think I saw the phrase from John Mueller, the poor man, the poor man's introduction. And I'll go back to sitting down.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Mueller's term, the poor man's whatever. Oh, that's like, okay. So now the we can fix like some of the things I said. It's just a definition part of the manifold. It's this triple: E is the total space, M is the base manifold, the pi is the projection. I essentially said that, and the fiber over X is the submanifold project up. Not neatly, of course, you get all the submanifold, which is a fiber. And if I preserve diffeomorphism, it's a diffeomorphism. Diffeomorphism that takes fibers into fibers. Fiber bundles, again, I'm repeating what I said, if all the fibers are isomorphic, the fiber manifold for the fiber bundle, and can be written as a quadruple in this case, where F is down to the fiber. And in case you've heard about G bundles, if group G acts on a typical fiber as a manifold, then the bundle is called the G bundle. Natural bundles, that's when we get made more informally. If Fn is the category of fiber manifolds and fiber preserving morphisms, and MFm is the category of n dimensional manifolds and different morphisms, the natural bundle is a covariant functor F from MFM to FM such that every manifold M in the object class of the category is transformed to a fiber manifold in the class of fiber manifolds over M. And every diffeomorphism is transformed to fiber preserving morphism. So the natural thing to this. A geometrical object, a section of a natural bundle, it's called the natural or geometric object. And the definition of natural bundle implies that a natural bundle F automatically induces a fiber bundle structure on the fiber manifold Fn. Now we get to the part where we come to some physics at this highly abstract level. I'm making it the level of abstraction about as high as you can go if you're going to generalize tensor about as much as you can.
Are you going to use this generalization of fiber manifolds somewhere, or we can just always take bundles?
You can take bundles, but in proofs, it's often useful to take the most abstract, my philosophy is take the most abstract case you can prove the theory for, then you know what you really need and what you don't. So that's the reason why I like to speak or start with. Well, now, what is the choice of a natural bundle? It's essentially the choice of the ball, the choice of the game with what theory you're talking about. For example, if you want to do electromagnetic theory, Einstein-Maxwell electromagnetic theory, right? Then your choice of natural bundle will consist of the O2 object, symmetric tensor field, and the one form, the A, the right, if you want to write this with the negative theory, which is the tension, so that would be a bundle. A theory, then, is a rule for selecting a class of cross sections of the natural bundle. One could make this more complicated, and indeed, if one was going on to do much more detailed work, you'd have to. We usually use differential equations, which means you have to either go up to the first or second jet prolongation of your bundle, depending on whether you're in the first or second order differential equation. But At this abstract level, it's just to say it's a rule of selection for cross-sections of the natural bundle. A model is a choice of a particular cross-section, and a model of a theory, then, is a choice of a cross-section that obeys the rule that you let them be used to define the theory. The whole argument. Oh, yes, sorry.
But this is classical.
No, oh, everything is classical.
Totally classical.
Everything's classical.
Until then, it wasn't classical.
Okay, right. Well, I'm going to keep this at a high level of abstraction. It's possible. Now, my terminology differs from that you will often see, because I distinguish between covariance and general covariance. Because people often jump from this first thing to assuming the second must hold, and it ain't necessarily so, as I'll show you in a moment. And secondly, there's such confusion when the coordinate language is used, it's very important to make a distinction, so I'll just use this terminology in my way. Covariance is, if you demand that the theory be covariant, then the demand is that the theory be such that the choice of cross sections implies that when you take a particular cross section, which is in the class that the theory chooses, every cross section generated that one by a diffeomorphism is also a solution. But now the question is, are all these solutions generated by a diffeomorphism physically equivalent? That is by no means necessarily the case. Again, the color space gives you the example of what I mean. Suppose I take the color space of the metric. Well, suppose I gave you a rule for choosing the metric, which was covariant. Then you could drag and get one from one metric on the color space to another metric on the color space. But since the colors have those inherent properties, those would be different metrics. The distance between red and blue, let's say, you know, I happen to be figure one, it's brightly suited saturation. So let's just pick loosely. So the distance between red and blue would change if I change, if I drag the metric of the color space. Yes?
We got it the last issue again.
Which the last one? How can I tell?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, have you
got
to that?
No, I'm just about to get to that. So just read that and then you're at yours.
Maybe I did.
Yes. So you could ask, how could this fail? How could the covariance, if it has advanced, how could it have failed to have the general covariance? I'll just give you an example about it. If the points of the base manifold are individuated independently of the cross section, in other words, to use my previous line, if the base manifold is really an algebra and not geometry. But then the field equations plus any bounding conditions don't generate unique solutions. It's very easy to show that. That was Einstein's original pole law, H-O-L-E, law, dropped with the children, which held him up. At least was part of the reason it held him up from the time he adopted the metric tensor as a representation of the gravitational field, end of 1912, early 1913, until he adopted his final field equation, general field equation, end of 1950. So it's quite a long period of time. Now.
Regarding the general covariance, you can make any theory general covariance. If you take the total gravity, as we know, teach your physics, Poisson equation, it has some field equation effectively, and it has boundary conditions, and it generates unique solutions. I can make the theory general covariance, as we know. I haven't learned much.
You can make it trivially, what I call trivially general covariance, but remember that means that your base manifold, even Newtonian theory written as a four-dimensional, Newtonian computation written as four-dimensional theory, you still have a kernel geometry which is independent, which is non-dynamic. And therefore the structure of the base manifold you must preserve. You can say, well, I'm going to carry out all sorts of, I'm going to carry out transformations about everything. You still don't get, so that's what I call trivial general. Trivial covariance, but that does still remove your obligation to respect the unique space time structure which you've imposed on your base manifold, namely in this case the kernel geometry. So that you have an absolute time, you have a contravariant, rotationally invariant three vector structure. So it's not covariant in the sense I'm using, because you have to preserve that structure in the base manifold.
The solutions and the unique equations are unique to the boundary condition.
Yes, true but irrelevant to my point here.
But doesn't that mean that the real difference between general relativity and Newtonian gravity is that in the lambda there is a non-dynamic construction?
Exactly. As I had more time, I would develop that greatly. The four-dimensional formulation of Newtonian gravitation is sort of halfway house. The inertial gravitational structure is dynamized, the kernel geometry is not dynamized. And it's just enough, and yet they're compatible. There's just enough freedom that compatibility conditions allow, namely that the covariant derivatives of the chrono chronometry and geometry structure, which in this case are separate, vanish. That still leaves the freedom to do some gravitational potential.
So would you agree then that the innovation of general relativity is that the geometry is dynamical?
Not in the geometry, there is no kinematics about that. It's a much stronger statement.
But the thing that the funny one is amazing is that the issue of general covariance is not the key difference between Newtonian and Einsteinian covariance. Would you agree with that?
Well, what do you mean by general covariance?
There are no
kinematic structures inherent in the base manifold. Means essentially that all you cannot separate kinematics and dynamics, so these 2 points are not separate, in my way of thinking about it. See, what is it that the reason why I make the distinction between covariance and general covariance? If there were some pre-existing structures on the base manifold, the theory could be covariant and not general covariant. They just gave the example of color theory. And then you could have a kinematics which was independent of dynamics.
But by
denying that, essentially the only way you can deny that is to say there is no structures on the base manifold. Every property of the elements of the base manifold are properties they inherit from the relations from the cross section of the particle.
John, let me just ask you,
yes.
This is a key point that a lot of interest in.
Yes.
So it's clear we can have a discussion on this point. Would you rather wait till the end of the talk and then we have a discussion?
Yeah, why don't we do it on Mars?
Okay.
Just do it on Mars. So let's go back.
So you're, when we start the discussion again, you're on.
Yeah. So now, how can you avoid the whole lot? Well, if you think about it for a minute, you'll see, well, more than a minute. It's like a story about when Norbert Wiener gave a lecture, somebody asked about it, somebody said it's obvious. And he was puzzled. He left the room, came back 20 minutes later from his office, smiled, and said, yes, it's obvious. Anyway, if you think about it long enough, you'll see the basis for the whole argument is the possibility of independent diffeomorphisms of the base and the vibratory diffeomorphisms of each, that you can drag the cross sections without dragging the base. Because if you drag everything, that's what I call the trivial identity. If you drag everything, you change nothing. You can raise the bridge and lower the river, but if you raise the bridge and raise the river, or lower the bridge and lower the river, you have the same thing. So, do it with me. So, in other words, dragging a fibrous, it's a relative drag which is the important thing. It doesn't matter which you drag, it's a relative drag which is the important thing, and therefore the model will eliminate that possibility. So, the idea is start with. What was formerly a total space, just make that the only element you start with, and the only space you start with, and define an equivalence relation between its elements that defines fibre as a manifold. Fibre is essentially an equivalence relation. Now, there are tricky mathematical points there, because if you take a manifold and just arbitrary equivalence relation, you will indeed get, and then quotient, you will indeed get a space, but it may not even be a manifold. You have to be very careful, but I'm assuming that you know what so you started, you know what your aim is, so you'll always choose that equivalence relation, that the quotient will be a manifold. So you define M as that quotient space, and as I say, the tricky mathematics comes in there. If you just pick any equivalence relation, M will be a quotient space, so it won't be a manifold. But now you see the elements of M are automatically dragged along in a fibre preserving diffeomorphism, because they're only defined in terms of the quotient of the total space, but was given by the E, by the equivalence relation that defines the fibre. So you can't even formulate the whole argument because there are no longer these independent or relative draggings possible. Now, remember I said this accomplished several things. First of all, realize this Einstein's vision, no sure, no nothing. Let me give you the quote from that. That's on the next slide. Oh, thanks. This is one of the late Einstein quotes. I think this is from 54. On the basis of the general theory of relativity, space, as opposed to what fills space, has no separate existence. If we imagine the gravitational field, that is the function g i k, to be removed, there does not remain a space of the type, and he's in it. village to start their special activity, but absolutely nothing. And also not a couple of other spaces seems to be at the concept of the manifold. I mean, you didn't have the word manifold. So I think it shouldn't be back to that, that's actually great to use. But the analogy I like to give is the bathtub analogy. In special relativity, you're only with a fixed background space time structure. You fill up the bathtub with the field, right? You fill the bathtub with water, you pull the plug, the water goes down, the bathtub remains. General relativity, Einstein's vision is when you pull the plug, the bathtub also goes down. So literally nothing is left. But you see, we accomplished that with the, there's no such thing as an empty space, that is a space without a field. Space-time does not claim existence on its own, but only as a structural quality of the field. And of course, this removes one of the, the general relativity removes one of the basic objections to that point of view, because previously you would say, okay, you might take a relational point of view about space-time structure. We know that Leibniz and Huygens tried to take that point of view towards space-time, which only became Newtonian space-time. You have a couple of problems. First of all, think about the region where there is nothing present. In particular, that time they only had material objects, they didn't have fields to fill up the rest of space, but you could imagine that it might be fields that should fill up all of space. Well, you see, that can't happen in general relativity because there's always an inertial gravitational field, which is just a bit of physical field then. So there literally is no region where you don't have inertial gravitational field. Okay, going back to the previous slide. So you see how this is Einstein's vision, no field, no nothing, because if the base manifold is the quotient of the total space by the equivalence relation defined as vibrant, if you take away the total space, there's no base manifold left. But a problem remains, and this is the problem I thought something was referring to earlier, but perhaps not. The quotient space, if it is a manifold, has a fixed global topology, while different global cross sections of solutions of the field equation can be maximally extended by various criteria. I'll come back to that. On manifold, the global topology of which can vary. We know, for example, that if you take a little piece of a little slice of space time and solve field equations on it, well, let's say you solve for Schwarzschild solution, Schwarzschild solution of a certain mass m, right? Then you know when you extend that maximally, in this case using the criterion of, let's say, a maximal analytic extension, you get the Kurzweil manifold, right? Whereas if you'd start out with a local bit of Minkowski space and were not too careful and consider all the topological possibilities, you'd end up with Minkowski space and with the usual topology, right? So the little bit, as you extend it out, will lead to different results. And of course, these are just two examples. You have to have some criteria for your extension. Usually people talk about maximal geodesically, either time-like or time-like and no geodesic maximal sensibility. For static solutions, you might say analyticity. But anyway, given some criteria, you have some criterion for maximal extension, and you will end up with different global topologies on different sections. This situation is reminiscent of the analytic continuation of solutions to the Cauchy-Riemann equations in complex variable fields. One doesn't usually say, let me pick a Riemann sheet, right? And now with all the analytic functions that live on that Riemann sheet. Usually one proceeds the other way around. You start by finding a solution to the equations, Cauchy-Riemann equation, patch, and then continue analytically to construct the Riemann sheet on which the solution lives. Now, this technique can be formulated precisely and cleaned up in the language of germs and sheaves. Take little bits of the manifold, and you build up the sheet consisting of all compatibility conditions on the overlap in such a way that you get the maximal extension. And I emphasize again, this is being done now on manifold, not in the coordinate system. So it's not like coordinate patching. We're doing cross-section patching, so to speak. Again, anything that can be said in the geometry should be able to be said geometrically. Can this be done for general relativity, or even more generally for the geometric object system? Intuition says yes. It says yes, but so far no one has done in detail, as far as I know. Yes?
I'm very confused what you're trying to do here. I mean, analyticity is not normally regarded as physically necessary.
No, I just gave that as an analogy.
Right, but I mean, if you took a bit of a solution of the Einstein equation that was not analytic, then there would be no look whatsoever for extending it in the unique way. Would there be?
Wait, why? No, you can say if you look for the time like and or time like and null, be that complete solution. That's one of your criteria that's been proposed.
So there'd be an infinite number of difference. Kind of, and let's just say
how would you extend, well, structurally, you say
analytically. Structurally, using the analytics. Okay. But, I mean, let's just say space-time was a little
bit. Well, let's say I took a cylindrical wave solution, right, where I can give an exact solution. If I give that a catching, you think I could continue it arbitrarily using the criterion of geodesical, the time like in null geodesical complete?
Yeah, I mean, you could do something even more less bizarre than cylindrical wave, something just like an asymptotic exact space time with the gravitational.
No, but I think you give an exact solution in a patch.
Well,
I don't want to have a product, I want to give an exact solution.
Do you mean in closed form or something? I mean, in principle, we could have an exact solution in a patch.
And I'm assuming you give an exact solution, and there ought to be some set of criteria which leads to a maximal global form of that solution.
No, that can't be right. I mean, because there'll be other solutions, there'll be other possible wave characters somewhere else, and it'll still be, you can patch together either of those two things.
Because
their topology could be different.
You're saying if the fact that I choose a bit of the null surfaces on my patch doesn't try to continue again on the null surfaces, that could well be. But let's say you pick some criteria for continuing, or you say you have a class of maximal extensions. My point is you should not free assignment global topology. The global topology should come out of consideration of the solution in a patch. The general relativity time inherently moves from local to global. Would you agree on that?
Not if you said one patch. If you said on all the patches, all the local topology.
I'd say this has certainly not been done in detail, so you could well be right. I think that's the program that should be done, let's say. Once you investigate, what are the maximum possibilities that would exist for extension to global completeness? I think the criteria is global completeness, right? We start from a patch, we want to get to global completeness. So you're saying there may be many ways to do that. Okay.
I mean, then start.
But starting from different patches, you'll get different global completes, right? I mean, different cross sections, you'll get different global completes. That's my point. You should not prejudge the global topology.
Yeah, you can.
Well, that's what everybody does in loop-point gravity, for example. They assume their global free topology, and they say the fourth topology is the global three times the line, which is even a stronger
assumption. Yeah, well, that's
a weakness. Don't convince me. But you see, I agree that this is not been done in detail as a program, and you may well be right. That one will not be able to give a specific characterization locally to get a unique global completion. So I would say there's a class of global completions. I would certainly agree to that possible method. So then the question, but what stops me at the first step is if you look at the usual definition of sheaves of germs, they assume a fixed global topology then. So that one has to get beyond that. And in addition, as I indicated earlier, once you probably work in the first or second jet possible, because you start from a differential equation, and that's where the differential equation is live. Now I want to go to the other point I mentioned. Now this is, so far we've done generalization. We've done natural objects and generalization. Now, remember the other was abstraction. What happens if you drop the conditions of differentiability and even continuity? And this point, I figured with this, I would like to get things to come out right. But the idea here is here we use the concept of forgetful function. So we start with the category of fibered manifolds, and we have the orthomorphisms of the total space and the base space. In this case, there'll be different morphisms. An example would be fibered G bundles and principal bundles. Now, over here, forget about directionability, we get continuity, we get fiber spaces. Now they should be not stiff, they should be hung.
I'm sorry.
That's one piece of the technology that hasn't been selected. Okay, thanks. So I started from fiber manifolds, and the automorphisms of the total space would be different morphisms, the base space would be different morphisms, and the example would be fiber bundles, D bundles, principal bundles, blah, blah, blah. Then we apply a forgetful property, which means you're going to map onto the category of private spaces, where you only assume differentiability, but differentiability is not a forgetful category, so this should be home more business, not different more business. And then we this immediately concept of D space with D invariant equivalence relations. And over here, you forget about even the continuity, and then just get to private sets. And instead of homeomorphisms, you get permutations. And then you get sets with structure, and particularly G sets with G invariant equivalence relations. So this merely outlines what's done at great length in that paper that I cited at the beginning of the talk. And well, you might say, what's a physical instance to that? Let me just point that out. The fact that from a philosophical or more general point of view, the fact that when we talk about sets, sets of objects with essentially any class of relations defined in this language is very interesting. Particularly for those who believe maybe the thing has too much structure, that's one of the problems we have. Example, causal set theory people will not just one. The fact that one can follow in many of these issues in this language, or even the red functors, I think is helpful. As some examples, for general relativity. Now, many body problems, even classical quantum mechanics, the question of distinguishable versus indistinguishable particles. Distinguishable particles are more like an algebra in the original sense, whereas indistinguishable particles are more like a geometry. And indeed, we can use this whole language to formulate the theory in that way, using the permutation group on the particles as a way of mathematically putting on this framework. And again, I agree with the paper for the details. String theory, when you put it to the test, fails because you have the background space time structure, which is assumed 10, 11, I don't care how many dimensions, it's a fixed background space time structure, so it doesn't fit into this framework, flow off. Actually, this one will come better later on, but I didn't care what the criteria is. Causal set was an example where you would apply the set theory. And you need to take it. And this suggests the following viewpoint. I said very briefly in the previous slide that the fact that we have to use quantum statistics as the basic, not only for particles, but indistinguishable, both for fermions and bosons, suggests to us that the basic, suggests the following viewpoint. The basic building blocks of our current model of the universe, the elementary particles on the one hand and the points of space time on the other, both are individuated only in terms of the relational structures in which they're embedded. They have, using old philosophical terminology, they have quiddity, but not exceedity. Quiddity means you have a certain essence, a central property. A space-time point is a space-time point. It's not a logarithm, it's not a tree, it's not a giraffe. An electron is an electron, it's not a proton, it's not a neutron, it's not a... Okay, but how do you tell them apart? They don't have exceedity, that's the point. They don't have the thisness, the primitive thisness, which most philosophers assume everything should have. But the lesson of modern physics seems to be neither space-time points nor elementary particles have this primitive thisness. Then if you build, let's say we started with all these theories, you build up. And very interesting question, how does individuality emerge? Some sort of complexity is necessary. I would hazard, I guess, it only emerges at the level where you have sufficient complexity for some irreversible mark to be imparted on the system. How do I tell you apart? Remember that book, How to Tell Your Friends of the Apes. Well, how do you tell your friends of the apes? You can recognize their faces, which means there's some irreversible quality to their face, and then you can tell both your friends apart and as a class, the human beings from the apes, right? So that's going upward, the very interesting question of how structure emerges. That's both a, again, using philosophical terminology, it's both a synchronic and a diachronic question. How does structure emerge? You just look level by level. And in the evolution of the universe and time, how does it emerge? Was it there in the beginning? Seems unlikely. Well, then how did it emerge in time? So there's many interesting questions there. But on the other hand, as we look below, which those who are interested in quantum gravity are trying to do, we look at some deeper underlying structure for general relativity and quantum field theory. It seems unlikely that inherent individuality having disappeared, instead of looking at a level we're already at, some magically going to reappear at a lower level, which is sort of what the string theory people are assuming when they think there is a fixed background space-time structure of however many dimensions that they can start from. So this suggests to me that we move from general covariance to permutation invariance, the principle of maximum permutability, which applies to space-time points and eventual particles. whatever the basic entities of theory are, the quantum opposite group should be the maximum permutation group for that set of entities. And of course, for particle gravity, the big unknown question is, what are the basic entities? But we never, of course, set theory meets this criteria easily. It reminds me, like, remember Einstein's description of what happened in 1905. He said, when he was looking for constructive theory, by and by, he despaired of finding it, and he was looking for a formal principle which enabled him to make progress. So I suggest that permutation and this principle of permutation there can at least give us some help in making progress in showing us what kind of theories we should reject, even though it can't tell you what kind of theory we should take. So I hope to convince you that a high five with my is tasty, healthy, and not too hard to follow. Thank you.
I suggest, because there were several conversations that got started, that first we take questions that are outside the debate about meaning, general covariance, and Newton versus Einstein, and so forth. We take questions from other people, and then, once we've done that, we go back to this.
Let me put on the boxing gloves.
Anybody have any?
Well, I just want to make a comment, and let me first of all say I enjoyed your talk, and say just straight away and make a critical comment, I did enjoy your talk, but I'm quibbling about your statement at some point that you want to take the most abstract point of view possible. It seems to me that generally in physics, one has the opposite point of view, that one takes the most simplified point of view for the given problem. I loved your statement that we focus on problems. But then, given a certain problem, usually the way we proceed is that we can't solve it, and then simplify it. We don't make it more abstract, we make it more simple.
Let me give you an example of, in practice, how this has worked out. Yeah. In my own working experience. You may know Chandrasekhar's work on the post-Newtonian approximation. He derived the approximation was by hand from the post-Newtonian field equation, and it involved 13, 14, 11 pages and pages. So I had a student who was working on the post-Newtonian, this is in Rose, starting out, but I had a student who was working on the post-Newtonian approximation, and we did it from Lagrange. Now anybody knows when you have Lagrange, you look at the symmetries of Lagrange, and from the symmetry you derive a conservation laws in three steps. So ascending to that level of abstraction led to immediately everything he did at this tremendous course. I mean, he was a great calculator, so for him maybe it wasn't a great course, but let's say for the poor man, it would be a great course to go through those papers. Okay? And at the end, you might not be sure what you've got. Whereas when you make you go to that level of abstraction, you see that you've given a Lagrange because of symmetry, and for every symmetry, we have the symmetries of the approximate Galilean group, and for every symmetry that corresponds to conservation, well, you derive the result and somehow with deeper insight and confidence in what you've done. And it seems to me, in general, it's useful to go to the highest, well, at least the more that I can do, maybe my style of thinking. It's useful for me, having often learned things at great cost, to realize that much of what I've taught in the package is not necessary. And I'll give you what to me is the supreme example. Most books in general relativity start out from the metric, and they only produce the affine connection much later on. And therefore you learn many things which seem to you, as you learn them, to depend on the metric. And then you find out they don't. They only depend on the connection. For example, Peter Harvest showed many, many years ago that just the connection and assume the conservation law for a stretch energy tensor. And then put into a model of stretch energy tensor, the equation of motion follow from the conservation law. Now that's, for me, a very interesting result. It has nothing to do with the metric. It's just the conservation law connected with the connection. And in general, I guess I was very lucky because I read two books on general relativity. You know, one, Einstein and the meaning of relativity. The other was Schrodinger's space construct. And Schrodinger's space construct has, I think, just the right approach. He starts the most abstract level. You have a bare manifold. What can you do on a bare manifold? So you can do one form, two forms, you can do abstract, you can do abstract, you can lead derivatives. I'm not saying there's no alternative, but you can start thinking in this way. What can you do on a bare manifold? You can do a lot. And it's very important to know what you can do. Then if you do the connection, what can you do? And then you do some metrics, what can you do that you couldn't do before you had this? So it seems to be very important to proceed systematically in your own understanding to know what is necessary in each stage. And maybe I overdo it, but at least you see the motivation. It has been important for me in understanding my approach to general relativity, both my own understanding and this example of Chandrasekhar versus my student, who was not a Chandrasekhar, but he was able to do in seconds what Chandrasekhar took pages to do because this was an abstraction.
Yeah, well, I agree totally with you. When you have a result, you should try to re-derive it in the most general way possible. But usually, before you know what's going on, I think you should proceed the other way.
But I must say, I think a category theory is useful precisely for that reason. It leads one to think in terms of the most general ways of. What are the most general properties that you can produce? And if it, you know, mathematics proliferates so much, any device helps us to encompass a lot of important mathematics without case by case, but subsuming it in some general structure is very important.
Well,
Travis,
I was
just regarding this issue, I think maybe what Peter was getting at is that when you start a theory, and Einstein started thinking about gravity. Then start with, as he did, very deep well of physical intuition. Then he gave a talk in Tokyo, went to Japan, and he explained that he was sitting in his office at the patent office in Japan in 1995. And he thought about a man falling off a roof.
Make it upset.
He formed into free fall, there would be no gravity. And this was, he said, when he told you, that he almost fell out of his chair. This is the legend. But the point is that this is where it starts. And then you build the theory up, and eventually you make it very mathematical and very abstract, which is fine. At the beginning,
well, this is a different question. This is the question that started before, and I have an introduction, by the way, to
Can I just take a for, I mean, Johns Hopkins was aimed to make a particular statement, a particular argument about the structure of general relativity and its interpretation. And this is, it has nothing to do with how general relativity was invented, how you solve the problem of general relativity. The question, I think, it seems to me he used the right level of abstraction for the question that he was addressing.
I would like to say a word about development generally, because I think it illustrates precisely the importance of having the right tools. It's often said Einstein found the mathematics he needed ready to hand, and Boson told him that, but he didn't. What they had at hand was Riemannian geometry as developed without the concept of parallel transport, which is essentially tensor concept at that time was a great invariant theory, very little of it in geometric interpretation, except the Gaussian curvature interpretation, which is not helpful at all to try to understand why curvature has anything to do with gravitation. What was missing was the concept of connection. And this is the thing which held up Einstein most, I think. It's painful, you see in his notebook. He has things written in terms of the Christoph symbols, and he carefully takes them apart so he gets things written in terms of the first derivative of the metric, because he thinks that's the representation of the gravitational field. So the fact that the concept of connection had not been developed, as I indicated earlier, I think it's a post-mature concept. It could have been done any time after Grassmann developed the concept of affine spaces, homogeneous affine spaces. And Riemann had made the move from global to local at the level of the metric. Why didn't somebody do it at the level of the parallel concept? But that really held up Einstein. And once he understood the concept of affine connection, he considered that the most important thing about it. General relativity, connection concept. So again, I think it indicates the level of abstraction was not high enough. He had to make do with the metric when what he needed was at a higher level of abstraction, connection.
Good. Any other questions? Started off the floor. Okay. So I think we were. And let me just say, for the people who don't know, there is a long-ranging discussion about the meaning of different works and invariants that we are about to get into, but John's talk was addressed to that. Those of us who know the discussion know that it was addressed to that. So we should interrupt if it's not clear. This is since this has been a discussion amongst experts for decades.
I think I gave a talk in Sweden in, what was it, 87?
Yeah, John, yes, in 1987, which influenced a number of people who influenced the development of pornography. For example, Carlo Vallis said that that talk changed his life and led him in the direction of looking for pornography development. So anyway.
Yeah, I could say Carlo reminded me of my life. My life was wonderful.
So I have one question regarding the quote, the nomadic nomad quote. It seems to me that Einstein thought that he had already done his major achievements, so that we have nomadic animals based on nomadic homicide. But you're trying to achieve that.
No, I'm saying that if you look at, I skipped the point. Since Lichtenrovich, I think, first did in 1939, the way of deducing general relativity by mathematically sophisticated was start with a manifold and then impose structure time. What I'm saying is that doesn't meet Einstein's criteria. So the fibered space, the fibered space method does.
But I have a different view. I think it's the manifold is only in coordinates that formulate dynamics in the equations and so on. But once you get the solution, you can eliminate the manifold. And I can show you afterwards, it's very simple to do.
Which manifold?
The manifold you formulate the field equations.
The base manifold?
Yes.
But you can't eliminate the manifold that was listed to it, right? The total equation.
No.
But I want to eliminate the base manifold. So I start by eliminating it as an independent entity.
So Einstein's quote, he says that there's no base manifold in spectrum.
Well, that's my interpretation.
Okay, so what is your goal? Is it to eliminate the base manifold, or is it to eliminate?
You eliminate the base manifold as an independent entity.
Yes. So
it's just the quotient of the total space by the fibering relation.
Is it something that has been done already, or is it something that has been done? Because I got the impression that you're saying it has to be done. It's still something left.
No. Well, I think we have done it in this paper.
Okay, but I already think it is done in general relativity. And I think it's one thing.
Well, you're showing the textbook where it's done. I mean, this is a way of presentation.
Tell me exactly what I'm showing you. Okay. How to eliminate the manifold once.
I said, show me the textbook where it's done.
Sure.
Okay.
So maybe we should discuss this.
I don't think I disagree with what you're saying. I'm saying it is not part of the standard way of presenting general.
No, I agree. And it's also very.
And it should be. That's what I'm saying.
It's also connected to how you construct observables. In constructing observables, you have really standard sort of manifold. So I'm very grateful
Well, what do you mean by general covariance? How do you make it general covariance? Tell me what space is. Tell me what space is and what.
Okay, you take a Poisson's equation and you turn it in a plastic.
So you're on the second jet of what?
Yes, you're bringing the covariance down, don't you? You're up to acting on the scale of two. And you get an into T and energy intensity, which is just a trace.
No, but I want you to see systematically. Tell me what spaces you're talking about. And I think you'll see that general energy is not, you're performing precisely what you mean by general.
I think you can do it. I mean, I think people, this is Cartan formula.
Yeah.
In particular, the follow-up.
It's not general covariance.
I've never found an idea of development where I think it's got in a fully, I mean, it's basically that thing, but it's expressed in a language that's fully covariant. So you don't introduce any a priori.
It depends what you mean by fully covariant.
Well, so it's absolute
conflict, yes.
What?
It connects absolute objects. Yes, exactly.
So what
absolute
objects?
The actual time
we're there. No, it doesn't. Of course, it's all by a trick, but it contains
Or you have a different expression than one solution?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
It's a collection. Algorithm collection, it's a temporal metric, and it's an Euclidean geometry.
This is not important.
No, that's not the right thing.
Well, this is the Newton.
So you do this, okay? And you solve the incorrect answer, you get the wrong answer.
You get the what?
You get the incorrect answer.
You solve the what answer?
The Newton answer.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. The what? So then I come along and I think, well, the scalar field does work in that equation. So I go to him and I say, let me try 10. Okay, so I put in a tensor, T U U. Now fuck Russian physics in his book. That's Kohlberg, Dalogershin, von T U U, equal to T U U. There's a condition, a race type condition on the metric tensor, T U U coming in with a zero. And then I have everything. And when you solve the Korean Vance correctly and get it right, you get all the correct answers. So in what sense?
You've asserted it, you haven't shown me how to do this in a systematic manner that I proceed.
It's straightforward. You take the Cobain-Newtonian Poisson equation and you write down what you would get for a tensor.
How do you call write it down for me, the Cobain-Newtonian Poisson equation? Does it have a metric in it?
Yeah, well, okay. That's the point. You have to construct the Cobain derivation operator, which
you can. When you write it out in other papers, you get it as a metric.
That's done with the tensor that I'm putting in instead of the scalar. It has a determinant, it takes square root, and you get a Cobain operator. So this is a different derivation of G up, and it's correct. It has a Lagrangian. So you could have done this without going about, so to speak, going about the man Jones.
And what would have been the topology of the base manifold?
Well, then I can do some mathematics afterwards. But this theory agrees with all the observational things. It's a parameter.
Lots of things agree, but they're conceptually quite different. For example, a lot of people think it's interpretation of relativity. There really is a flat background space time and constant space time. And gravity, which has an inertial connection attached to it, and you literally the standard inertial gravitational connection, literally those two is a tensor. So that tensor field, this gravitational tensor field, distorts the behavior of measuring rods and clocks so that the flat background space time, which is really there, is unobservable. But I would say, if you want to do that, why you start with special relativity? Let's take Minkowski's interpretation of special relativity. There really is a flat, there really is an ether frame of reference, and motion through the ether kinematically distorts the behavior of measuring rods and clocks, so that you can never observe the ether frame of reference. So let's go back to the ether frame of reference and build a general relativity step by step. First special relativity, then general relativity. Well, we don't find that very satisfactory. I think he had to use the Hedges criteria that model is preferred, which has a less superfluous elements. So you've introduced the ether, which is superfluous, because everything you've done is to make sure that you never have any influence of that ether on the physics. And similarly, you develop a background Minkowski spacetime, you then build up general relativity in such a way to make that superfluous. So,
in
natural interpretation,
I'm not promoting this fight. When I taught my TR class, for several years, I did not do general relativity in this way. I did actually.
Yes, but I think if you introduce absolute objects and then do everything possible to make sure these absolute objects are unobservable, then why?
Basically, getting back to this question, what is the essential difference between Newtonian gravity and Einstein gravity? And I think it's the fact that you have 10 potentials. Not what? So the ratio of that is not the difference. You have to try to find the gravity theory with the experiment. This is what physics is.
But what about gaps of time? You don't consider that.
As soon as you write down Cobain-Dalogershin, gravity information.
Because, by the way, if you write Newtonian four-dimensional version of Tony's theory in
the system of special relativity.
You're right in the quadratic independent form. You can deduce now potentials for the stationary field. Notice I can have four gravitational potentials in the terms. And without going beyond the framework of Newtonian theory. You know, the quantum geometry remains Newtonian. But you have to write Newtonian theory in terms of independent quantum geometrical and inertial gravitational.
You have to make consistent.
So your one potential argument would hold. I have four potentials in my first theory. And it's only when I go to the post-post Newtonian order that, where I would induce 10, that you see an effect on the background quantum geometry can no longer remain Newtonian at the post-post Newtonian. If I could develop a consistent theory, which I'd have 10 potentials and still wouldn't be general relativity. It would be post-post Newtonian, general relativity.
Well, the Fox presentation of general relativity is in terms of 10, 15 years, and what's called the Fox covariant dilatation, that's it.
Well, you said covariant dilatation of the metric, meaning the quadrant dependent dilatation.
It's only covariant dilatation from the
You restrict yourself to a class of coordinate system, so you reduce the Diffie Hamiltonian group. You reduce the Diffie Hamiltonian group to some.
So six potential because of the Lorentz condition.
Yeah.
This is a perfectly consistent.
It's equivalent to them. It's not different from general relativity.
No.
Except in an interpretive level.
It's different. It's conceptually different.
It's conceptually
different. I have a question which I mean, right there on a long standing disagreement between us, but it might not. and it's related to this way you have putting it, which I think is very neat. But I'm not quite sure if it works, liquidity versus exity point of view here. And I just wonder. I think homogeneous macroscopic space as the elements would be your subset in the homogeneous. I mean, they are not individuated by any metrical structure anyway, so it isn't an algebraic.
So the word isotropic wouldn't apply in no directions, it's just homogeneous.
Okay, so I'm taking this to do with homogeneity. But then the suggestion is that, okay, if you have a fixed background, then you are halfway to reintroducing as many exits, and this is the point about
you need much less. You specify a few elements and the rest follow.
Yeah,
you need to have space time if I give you an origin point.
Yeah,
three unit vectors.
So one of the string theorists who says, well, I'm not going to, although I need less, I'm not going to introduce anything at all. So my background space is going to remain homogeneous space. I'm going to stay in this realm of quiddities, if you like, rather than exodus. So, what is
well, Brian Greene says, if you read his book, I have a long book from another book.
Yeah, no,
he said, we'd love to do this, but we don't know how. That happened. You know, when you write x1 squared plus x2 minus x4, that's the metric, it's the background metric just hidden in that sum of the differences of squares.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get at is the mere fact that you've got a background metric doesn't seem to force you all the way to something like an algebraic. It's true that it makes it easier to make that extra move to introduce exodus, if you know. But you don't have to make that extra move. Now maybe Brown-Green says, oh, well, in fact, in practice we do, but then that becomes the problem with string theory. Not so much having a background space. That they
meant
that extra.
No, what I'm saying, I'm not emphasizing so much liquidity and exceeding in my formulation, maximum permeability, but the fact that the tendency seems to be that as we go deeper and deeper, we enlarge the automorphism group and we drop all the impediments to the maximum automorphism group. I'm suggesting that as you go further down, I mean, it's a guess.
Sure.
I won't be around to see the result, but the guess is that we're not going to somehow have it suddenly reappear.
Right.
As it does in string theory, if you get to a deep enough level.
Sure, I agree with that, but it seems to me that what we don't want to suddenly have reappear is absolute structures rather than excesses.
Maximum permeability, I would say.
Okay, but then maximum permeability seems more into the anti-excesses. in the quilies alone, rather than now it's in structure.
It's more, yes, I agree. Yeah. So that's,
okay.
It's more, and that, I mean, if it is useful, that will be what makes it useful, because it eliminates more theories.
It's less, but it's also less, because you can have the anti-hexitism going without some structures. You always have that option.
Well, you have to give an example of that.
Well, just the Newtonian space-time seems to me, unless you start to integrate the parts.
Yeah, but you just need to individuate a few things.
Yes, yeah, so if you don't individuate anything, then it seems to me
you can't do physics. Because I have to tell you, the point of the space-time is not just to do mathematics, but I have to put a piece of apparatus here to generate a two-tone quantity. I have to put a piece of apparatus here to generate some process, and then over here to measure or register the results.
Yeah,
but we don't use the space-time structure just for the two. We have to individuate, point out the place where we put the apparatus.
We can do that with a dynamic individuation.
I think ultimately you get down to the fact you have to, when you want to interpret your formulas, you have to actually say, put something here and put something there. And that something is not part of the closed system. And this is the Bohr's point of view, or Bohr final point of view, that quantum mechanics doesn't deal with closed systems, deals with open systems. The input is the apparatus that generates the process, and the output is the apparatus that registers.
I wasn't doing quantum mechanics, so I was just
thinking. It's true, I mean, in the non-autistic quantum mechanics, too. Even more so.
Yeah, but I mean, let's just stick with classical theory. Sure, quantum mechanics is a big topic, so let's just leave.
Well, classical theory can also be formulated in that open way.
Okay.
Like, I produce an ensemble. I mean, the closest analogy for me to a wave function is an ensemble. Because an ensemble is built on knowledge of half of possible information which you could give to pick out a particular trajectory. So, in phase space, you take an ensemble which is distributed evenly over the remaining half of the information. And then when you look at it in the configuration space, you see you get very black determinants in terms of the density in the configuration space, so there's even distribution in phase space. And that's how you build up a classical analog of wave function. This is the deepest understanding that you have of quite very few classical quantum theory, at least in the analog. So you would sort of say, yes, I have, in that sense, I take an apparatus which produces this ensemble, and then look at apparatus to see where physically, what the probability I will find what I predicted it would, using this kind of classical wave function. So you can also give that kind of a produce register interpretation of the classical wave.
Let's take the last question from our panel, and we have to follow the key. John has to do some way to get ready for the game tonight.
Well, I wanted to go back to try to restate in a certain way the point that I think Anthony was trying to make early on, which is that in a certain way it seems that even the best mathematical description we have, doesn't use coordinates as such, still preserves some remnants of this X, which we call Hexia. And I think it shows up in the fact that we can, and take your case of the bundle, let's take the total space, the real thing, so that we can bypass the whole argument. Nevertheless, there are diffeomorphisms. One can imagine diffeomorphisms of the bundle of the space E into itself.
Neither one preserves the fire.
Okay, let's say they do preserve the fire. And then they can carry everything along, because by definition you don't have the base space anyway. There's still that statement that diffeomorphism makes no physical difference.
Yes, that can be put in model theory language.
What would like, I think,
every true statement in one model is a corresponding true statement in the category one model. We deal with these issues.
But this is
generally true in model theory, that there are.
Well, that may be because mathematics as a whole still preserves, has quite come to grips with objects that have fluidity but not activity in your language.
It is even to do with that. It's just the fact that you take a set of relations and you transform everything including the relations and the objects, and you don't produce it. You might produce a mathematically different looking model, but in any interpretation, there's going to be an isomorphism in the interpretation of this model.
Well, that's right.
The same semantics.
So one would like to say that it's not really a different model at all. In the same way, one would like to say that the sibiomorphism that carries everything along has literally done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the mathematics as we have it now, it has done something, and then we have to go.
Well, there are ways to do that.
Something is nothing. I think that's what Anthony wants.
Right, there is a step further you can go. If I can give a particular example, let's say we deal with Einstein-Maxwell theory, right? You can say the following, and then you remove all freedom. Let's assume it's a generic case, so we don't get into the case of symmetries. You go to the point where the four invariants of the Riemann tensor have the following values. That's nothing to do with coordinates, has nothing to do with anything else, right? And there you measure the invariants of the Maxwell theory. And my theory tells me to do these values. So this is as Shimansky would say, you pick up the telephone and tell someone what to do about this. So it's clearly it's independent of any representation. Go to the point where the Riemann, the four invariants of the Riemann tensor have the following values and see if electromagnetic.
I'm not saying that such a formulation doesn't exist. I'm just saying that Anthony, I think, was asking for such a formulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a sense in which we still lack. I'm not saying you couldn't get it by developing things
in this
way, although, as you say, there are technical
problems. I think it's very closely related to the question of measurement theory. We need a good measurement theory for interpretation. You've got any theory of quantum gravity has to be associated with a measurement theory. And there, I might say, what worries me, for example, about the quantum gravity interpretation, they said there's an area operator and there's a volume operator, but these are kinematic concepts, so they're already doing kinematics without dynamics. So yes, this may be true, but when we go to the dynamical level, what's going to happen? In particular, the lesson of quantum field theory seems to be that the only things you can measure are smeared out over four-dimensional bodies, not three-dimensional bodies. And you don't know how to smear out over time in quantum gravity, so it's not clear what the result is. Okay, four-dimensional. So in other words, it violates prematurely interpreting results, allow it to know kinematics without dynamics.
So, since we're doing that, I love to say that's it for criticism. The fact that we have to close this because we have to get ready for tonight. So let's thank John again. And
thank you for your patience.
And John is here also tomorrow for a people discussion, and we hope next time again.
Well, don't give us a lie. Give us the new introduction. Besides that point, that's the offer
rate
for that.
Come
on.
I have my computer on my app.
Yeah.
So that means
I'll take a photo. I assume so, yes.
Yes. Obviously.
Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, that's